It's Central Time. I'm Judith Sears Poisson. Thanks for spending your holiday with us on the Ideas Network. Coming up, a new Gallup poll out this week says Americans aren't feeling as proud of the U.S. during the Trump presidency. We'll have a conversation about what it means to be patriotic in 2019 and changing attitudes about the idea of patriotism. First, the United States is a country founded in many respects on ideas. But defining big concepts like equality, liberty, self-interest, and America's place in the world have always been a messy process. But that ongoing conversation has given life to our culture and politics over the past few centuries. It's also the basis for the field of intellectual history, which our next guest says is a way to eavesdrop on the past. Jennifer Ratner Rosenhagen is a professor of history at UW-Madison and the author of several books. Her latest is The Ideas That Made America, A Brief History. She spoke with Central Time host Rob Ferret earlier this year.
Why tackle the study of history through the lens of ideas?
Spending now my life doing this, I can't imagine any other way of wanting to do it. There are a couple of reasons. One is why most people, I think, are drawn to history is because they're drawn to thinking about how people in the past made sense of themselves, you know, how they made a life for themselves, how they made a world for themselves. And what better way to do that to then, as I say in the book, you know, eavesdrop on how they think about themselves, how they think about their world, how they think about the major problems of the day. So I think it's a way of kind of closing up the distance between us and people in the past and being in a conversation with them.
And speaking of conversation, I hope you don't mind me spoiling the last line of your book.
Uh-oh.
And so the conversation of American thought continues. And that seems like a running theme. It's not just these isolated parade of ideas. It's ideas that cross national boundaries, that cross the boundaries of decades, too. These things keep interacting in new and unexpected ways.
I'm glad you picked up on that last line. The last line of a book is always a hard one, right? Because you want to stick the landing. And it's funny that you pick up on that because the book was provisionally called American Conversations. I think to make the point that American intellectual history, you know, you can talk about it as a tradition, but that makes it sound so formal, so complete, you know, as if it's this artifact that gets handed down from one generation to the next. But that's not how ideas work. That's not how history works. It is an ongoing conversation. People across time, across the expanses, you know, of history, across places, and then, of course, across national boundaries, sometimes linguistic boundaries. And so that is the approach of the book, and I think the approach of intellectual history more broadly is to see how Americans have talked with each other and past each other and sometimes shouted at each other about the things that were most important to them.
And another theme that I think runs through the book is the people who weren't part of the conversation or who were omitted from the conversation sometimes, but were unmistakable parts of it still, from the early interactions of Europeans and Native Americans, from slaves in America, women throughout the history you look at. They weren't not there, but in some ways they were ignored in the main, what we think back on in the main intellectual conversation. Can you talk about the role and the importance of looking at their voices too?
Thank you for noticing that. That was a challenge of the book. It's a challenge of intellectual history in general, because typically intellectual historians look at, you know, sources like books, magazine articles, newspapers, broadsides, sermons. And for much of American history, who got to go on record, of course, were white men, propertied men, which meant that people of different backgrounds, women weren't as easily, you know, traceable on the record. So that is always the challenge of the intellectual historian, is to widen out from those traditional sources to try to listen to the mental, you know, the records of the mental and moral worlds of others. So that was a challenge to do, but they're there. You know, you have people like Judith Sargent Murray, who's an important Revolutionary era thinker, someone like a Frederick Douglass, who was, you know, one of the most important orators of the 19th century. So the records are there. We just have to look for them.
Talking to Jennifer Ratner Rosenhagen from UW-Madison. Her new book is The Ideas That Made America, A Brief History. I want to take a whirlwind tour. You cover a lot of ground in the book. Let's start with the first contact between Europeans and Native Americans. As you write about it, and I haven't really thought about it this way, just the existence of Native Americans on this continent, led to a lot of reflection about who the Europeans were and the European mm-hmm. settlers in America and how they all fit into the world and the history of the world.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's something easy to forget, and partly because the lore that we've inherited through our history, but frankly, some of these European settlers had, which was of a vast open continent, an Eden, or in some cases, a place forsaken by God, where there was not strong enough recognition that there was, in fact, a native populations here and in the hundreds of millions. So for the first 100 years, at least, European settlers and explorers are dwarfed by the Native American population here. And so that's an example, Rob, where you ask me, where do you listen? How do you listen for those silences? Even if we are listening into Puritan era sermons and Native Americans are not mentioned, we as historians know they were there. They were there, right there in the same towns, right on the outskirts. And so kind of looking for the presence of what seem like absences are presences throughout. And so this is any look at early American thought, we have to listen in. Sometimes it's articulated and sometimes it's muffled about what it meant to be a displaced person, whether it was from Germany or France or from the British, somewhere in the British Empire, or even Spain or Portugal, to be landed here on this new continent surrounded by, all enormous a number of people with a different tongue, different ways, different cultures, and to feel that sense of alienation and estrangement that came as a result of that.
Moving ahead to another challenge, with the revolution predicated on ideas of freedom and liberty and self-determination and equality, and then the contradiction of slavery going on, as you write, actually not just out there, but right at the universities where people were thinking about these things and having to come up with the intellectual framework. And that led some people to abolitionism, saying if we want to be consistent, we have to end slavery. Others saying, no, we're not equal. Here's how we justify this inequality.
Yeah. Thank you for putting it that way. That's very helpful. And I think something that I tried to do in the book, it's not always easy, but that is, I think there's a temptation for Americans when they think about their past to sort of think about it as a split screen. The North is free and the South, is a slave, or, we've got freedom over here and we've got, some sort of bondage or slavery. And actually the two they're not mutually exclusive. They happen in the same spaces. So you mentioned, early American universities. That is something I talk about in the book. Every single early American university is founded on dispossessed land, lands that's dispossessed from Native Americans. Every single American university, in one form or another, has slaves who are building the actual buildings, literally the foundations. Harvard University, it used to be one of the bonuses of becoming the president of Harvard. You had your own personal slave there. We've got examples of students bringing their slaves to school with them. And so right there at the sites of learning, where they're learning, in some cases, the great ideas of the Enlightenment, which is freedom, self-rule, self-determination, is happening in the context, on dispossessed lands in the presence of people who are there in bondage. And many, I would even say a vast majority of these folks are not noticing the dissonance, of those two things. So that's something that I try to focus on the book, not look at slavery and freedom as separate, but how do they work together? I'll give you another example. Thomas Jefferson, one of our most important thinkers about freedom. We can't think about American freedom without thinking about Jefferson, who over the course of his lifetime owned 600 people and had 5 children with his slave. These are not, you have to hold it together, that he's writing Peons to Liberty while he has an army of slaves serving him. It doesn't discount the work. It doesn't delegitimize it. It just complicates it.
We're listening back to a conversation with Jennifer Ratner Rosenhagen about her book, The Ideas That Made America, A Brief History. And we want to hear from you. What big ideas do you think have been central to our culture, our society, or our politics? What thinkers do you see as having changed the country with their ideas? Do you think we still have the ability to debate and wrangle with some of the concepts we've been talking about? Tweet us at Central Time WPR and let us know. We'll pick up the conversation after this short break. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Judith Sears Poisson. We're listening back to a conversation with historian Jennifer Ratner Rosenhagen about her book, The Ideas That Made America, A Brief History. What do you think? Which ideas and people do you think have had the biggest impact on America, for better or worse? Have you seen ideas about things like equality, self-interest, or religion change in your lifetime? Tweet us at Central Time WPR and let us know.
Jennifer, reading through your book, one idea that came back to me, and I remember from high school, and I realized almost nothing about it, transcendentalism. This is one of those things that people point to as a key, fundamental American, uniquely American in some ways, school of thought. Mm-hmm. Remind us what that is.
Perhaps it's easy to forget or want to forget because of its unlovely name, transcendentalism. Even the transcendentalists didn't want to be called transcendentalists. So there's a funny, you know, internal dialogue among Ralph Waldo Emerson and Margaret Fuller and others who just thought this was sort of clunky and silly. So the transcendentalists, for those of your listeners who also have a vague recollection from high school of like, we're typically referring to a group of liberal, very literary intellectuals, mostly around the Boston area in the 1830s, 1840s, 1850s, where many of them, and I mean, you know, well, the names are Nathaniel Hawthorne, Henry David Thoreau was considered in this orbit, Herman Melville, et cetera, et cetera. And obviously the biggie is Ralph Waldo Emerson. And they're a group of friends, sometimes frenemies. Some of them are liberal Protestant ministers. Other of them are apostates like an Emerson. But they're all committed to a kind of intellectual project and are working on it together. And that is basically, it comes down to a couple of things. First of all, what the transcendentalists share is a sense that Americans had achieved their political independence from the old world, but not necessarily an intellectual or a cultural independence. And so what we see with Emerson, and you know, we know it's the self-reliance, right? His big idea of self-reliance and others was the idea of what would it be like to start an intellectual culture, you know, a set of ideas, a kind of literature that was genuinely organic to our democratic project, genuinely organic to this new world, and not something that we're just inheriting, you know, sort of secondhand from Europe. The second part of it is that what makes the transcendentalists is that they understood that democracy is more than just a political organization, you know, or institution. Democracy would have to also reflect the whole human personality, or in their words, the human soul. So what they're committed to through poetry, through writing, through sermons, through utopias like Brook Farm, was the idea of actually cultivating a democratic personality, a democratic soul.
Let's bring on a caller now. Jeff is with us in Superior. Jeff, hi.
Yes, thank you. This is a fascinating topic, something I've been interested in for many years. I ran for political office in 2008, and in my process of running for the Wisconsin State Legislature, I had a dream about Benjamin Franklin. And I know it's going to sound silly, but I've had a number of dreams in my life about my ancestors and stuff. Well, he came to me and he told me that Barack Obama was going to be the next president and that this was a great moment for our country. And I asked him, I said, oh, really, why? And he said what you just said about the idea that democracy is a reflection of your soul and philosophy and mm-hmm. community and those kinds of philosophical, mystical aspects of society are really a reflection of oneself.
Mm-hmm. Jeff, thanks a lot for the call. Does his dream version of Ben Franklin match up to the reality?
Oh, my gosh. Well, first of all, I just want to thank you, Jeff. First of all, I want to thank you for your service. And second of all, I hope that all of our representatives are as intellectually curious and engaged as you are and also have a space for imagination or what you're calling your dreams. Because to be honest, I think the most magical moments in American history have come when people's dreams of what America could be outshot the reality. One thing I would say to Jeff is that there is a specific history in American political thought about dreams and dreaming. You know, the American dream as an idea. Martin Luther King, I have a dream. Obama, dreams for my father. There's no other political, no other politics that I'm aware of, it's certainly not in the Western world, where the language of dreams and dreaming figures so close into our political discourse. And I think that is precisely as what you're touching on, is the sense that there's something larger. What, you know, living a truly democratic life, building a truly democratic society is something that needs to is created through imagination, but also needs to leave some space for that imagination. So I hope that Franklin comes back to you again. He's a good person to visit, visit you.
Thanks a lot for that call. We're talking to Jennifer Ratner-Rosenhagen about her new book, The Ideas That Made America. I want to come to a more modern era now. We hear a lot in the political world about the rise of what people call identity politics, politics based on, say, race, gender, sexuality, things like that. And it's presented as a new thing. Mm-hmm. But looking back at the 19th century, I wonder, is it really so new?
I don't want to say it's old wine in new bottles, but it's just a new term for a long-standing, if you will, debate or concern in American life. And I would say, I mean, you mentioned the founding, even before the founding, when Europeans arrive in this continent, what do they have in common? Nothing. I mean, you know, there are people from Europe who came from different tongues, different religious groups, different classes.
They might well have killed each other if they're in the wrong country in Europe.
Exactly. Absolutely. And so what happens already, you know, right from the outset in this American experiment is people trying to figure out what is the we, you know, what holds us together as Americans when we have different faiths and we have different tongues. And so the idea of difference, diversity, questions of inclusion have been there right from the start. And we've addressed these questions differently. We've allowed, you know, some people in and some people out over time. We've redistrict, if you will, the we. But that question about how do we live as one, you know, where do we find our unum out of our pluribus has been with us throughout American history. And identity politics is important and significant, but it's another term for a longstanding problem and possibility, if you will, in a pluralistic America.
I also want to talk about, and coming back to an idea we talked about earlier, the way ideas flow from one place to another. You give an example, I think it's in your introduction, about some of the things that inspired Martin Luther King. There's the Old Testament, but there's also Gandhi. Can you talk about the international flow of ideas that might lead to a pivotal thinker like Martin Luther King Jr.?
Well, that's something, you mentioned it's a brief book, so there's a lot of compression, but that is something I wanted to signal to my readers whenever I had the chance to, which is sometimes we think of ideas as American, but in fact they have foreign origins, or they crisscross across the globe to become what they are. So the backstory of a Martin Luther King, I mean, this isn't to minimize him. He's singular. He's an irrepeatable miracle in many ways. But Martin Luther King is getting many of his ideas from Gandhi. And Gandhi was an avid reader of Henry David Thoreau and Civil Disobedience. And so that's just one example of the kind of curious crossings, you know, both across space, so geographical crossings, as well as across, you know, expanses of human history that make for what we call this American intellectual tradition or American conversation.
Well, when I think about genius or a great thinker, it isn't necessarily someone who, I don't know how you would come up with ideas out of whole cloth, but it's somebody who takes what's out there and maybe reinvents them, reframes them for the current time.
You are channeling your inner Ralph Waldo Emerson, because this is precisely Emerson's point about the great genius is actually the most creative reader. So Emerson understood. Emerson is someone who was very, you know, interested in, again, not being derivative, not being secondhand, being his own Adam in history, you know, the first man at history, but understanding that there are intellectual influences coming to him. And so genius, I think, as it's expressed itself in America, is often taking something already there in the Bible, from the Constitution, from Benjamin Franklin, and doing something new with it, you know, reworking it for one's own moment, you know, seeing new possibilities in it. I think a great example, if I may just tuck one in here, is the Declaration of the Sentiment of Rights of Women, 1848. It's modeled on the Declaration of Independence, a time when it was considered, you know, that women could not be free and equal in the way that men could. But in 1848, what do you have but a group of women rewriting the Constitution, or sorry, rewriting the Declaration to declare the independence of women?
In our last minute or so, kind of bringing things home, it seems like another reason to study the history of ideas is these ideas, they're the water we're kind of swimming in, mm-hmm. and it's worth it to maybe take these things that we just take for granted and look at the time and place they rose in.
You could not have given a better bumper sticker for intellectual history. And this is something I try to talk about in the book. And if there's one thing I hope that readers take away, it's the one thing I hope my students take away is this, that every single conversation we have today, every debate, every conflict, intellectual conflict, everything that we agree on is not necessarily a product of necessity, or, you know, this is not all foreordained. It's a product of history. There's no conversation we're having right now that hasn't in some form or another been wrestled through, struggled through, debated through, you know, in the 1950s, in the 1900s, in the 1850s and earlier. And so to me, that's the great, you know, reward of intellectual history, is that as we wrestle with our post-truth moment, you know, our moment about identity politics, our moment about what's, you know, the state of our very fractured democracy, we can bring ourselves into conversation with some great thinkers and great writers and great advocates and activists from the past who have engaged those same problems in their own time. And sometimes they can help us figure some solutions, but sometimes they just keep us company too. You know, that there's a sense of you're part of something larger than yourself. Or we are at this moment because we're going through what many of our forefathers and foremothers have gone through in different form.
We'll leave it there. Jennifer, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
That was historian Jennifer Ratner Rosenhagen. She spoke with Central Time host Rob Ferret earlier this year about her book, The Ideas That Made America, A Brief History. Coming up after the news, we'll talk about what it means to identify as patriotic and how Americans' attitudes are changing about the term. And we'll ask you whether you think of yourself as patriotic and why. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. Coming up, two bills that would strengthen OWI penalties recently passed the State Assembly. We'll find out more about what they do and whether they're likely to become law. First, a new poll from Gallup out this week showed that Americans' pride in the U.S. is at an all-time low, with only 45% saying they're extremely proud to be Americans. This marks the second straight year that number was below 50%. And so today on this 4th of July holiday, we're going to talk about patriotism, what it means and how our ideas about it might be changing. Joel Westheimer is the University Research Chair in Democracy and Education at the University of Ottawa. He's also the author of Pledging Allegiance, The Politics of Patriotism in America's Schools. Joel, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you, Judith. Nice to be here. Happy July 4th.
Thank you. You've written about two different kinds of patriotism. Can you explain those for us?
I can, yes. I talk about an authoritarian patriotism and a democratic patriotism, and I'll quickly tell you about what each one is. We all know that every country has likes to celebrate the country and likes to, you know, every country has an Independence Day of some kind or a national celebration day. And that's wonderful. We all want to celebrate the things we're a part of. But totalitarian nations and authoritarian nations, dictatorships and so forth, tend to do that celebration through what I call an authoritarian kind of patriotism. And that is a kind of my country right or wrong patriotism, meaning that there's no place for criticism of government actions or of introspection into how we can become better or whether, you know, we have disputes that we might want to settle or improve the lives of people living within our country and outside of our country. So it's a kind of whatever the government says goes, and no one is allowed to question that. And we're familiar with those forms of patriotism. We've seen them all throughout history in North Korea and China and the former Soviet Union and so forth. A democratic patriotism, I coined that phrase because I didn't like the idea of for those of us who believe there is a place for critique and criticism of government policies and who believe that loving your country means standing up for the ideals on which the country was founded. I didn't like the idea that we had given up on the word patriotism, you know, that we weren't allowed to be patriotic, because for me, that's the highest form of patriotism. And so what I've seen in some programs in schools and in the way other people think and talk about patriotism is that patriotism means, you know, loving your country so much that you want to improve it and make it better. And at times that means standing up and saying that things are not right. And I call it democratic patriotism because it's a patriotism, a kind of patriotism that's not at odds with democracy, with a democratic form of governance. And the kind of patriotism we've seen throughout history where it's my government right or wrong, that is at odds with democratic governance and with issues of things like human rights, social justice, and ideals of freedom that our country was founded on.
Is that authoritarian type of patriotism often linked to kind of a cult of personality where it focuses on the leader maybe as much or more so than the country itself?
Absolutely. It's a cult of personality, and sometimes it's because people really are taken in by the charisma of a leader, or sometimes it's because that's forced on them. Other kind of signposts when you know a kind of totalitarian patriotism is going on is mindless. Well, this is going to be one close to your listeners and to us right now. Military parades, right, are a real prime example of a totalitarian kind of patriotism, because it's asking the country to come together to celebrate force and might over other countries. That's basically the message. Things that immediately come to mind, like the National Socialists in Germany, you know, marching in goose step, or China leading parades with missiles for it. Those aren't ideals that America was founded on. It doesn't mean that we aren't prepared to defend ourselves, but it's not what we choose to focus our celebrations and our pride on. What America was founded on, of course, you know, July 4th is such an interesting holiday in this way because it brings out these differences. But, you know, we all know that the 4th of July, I mean, our nation was born in a challenge to authority, right? We are a rebellious people, and dissent is part of our DNA because we decided to leave a different nation, namely England, and form our own. And so we celebrate the idea that dissent is the engine of progress in a democratic society, that you have to have multiple points of view, that you have to have different ways of looking at things, that you have to think critically about social policies and change them. That's how we got the civil rights movement. That's how we got the women's suffrage movement. It's how we got gay rights. That's the way a democratic society advances.
We heard from Linda on Facebook, who says that patriotism means not being complacent, because she says when you're complacent, you're complicit. And that really sounds like what you were talking about is at the key of democratic patriotism.
I think that's right. And you know what's so interesting about this, Judith, is that a lot of the symbols that people who lean towards a more authoritarian form of patriotism, a lot of the symbols that those groups embrace in our country, things like the Pledge of Allegiance, things like the Catherine Lee Bates, who wrote America the Beautiful, right? All those things were written and penned and created by really very left-leaning and often socialist members of our republic. And the reason they were created, let's just take Francis Bellamy For an example, Francis Bellamy is the original author of The Pledge of Allegiance. And the original pledge, which was in 1892, and it did not contain any reference to God at the time. But he was very critical of many of the trends of late 19th century American life, most notably unrestrained capitalism and growing individualism. He worried that school children, as well as adults, were starting to think only about themselves and about consumerism. It would be the equivalent of today of only thinking about, you know, your iPhone or your Facebook account and not about what it means to be part of something bigger than yourself. And he wanted America to reflect basic democratic values such as equality of opportunity. And he worked openly to have his country live up to its democratic ideals. And he was a self-professed Christian socialist. And that is why he penned the pledge. Now, was he patriotic? Of course. But it wasn't a patriotism of the authoritarian kind. It was a very democratic kind of patriotism. Catherine Lee Bates, who wrote America the Beautiful, was a poet at Wellesley College. And very similarly, she stood up and fought for a lot of the ideals of equality and freedom and liberty that that the country was founded on. And that's why she wrote America the Beautiful, because she, you know, she included the words, "America, America, God mend thine every flaw." And that was at the heart of what she wanted to get at. So the two of them and others wanted both adults and school children to think about the fact that life is more than just trying to get as much money as you want. And it's really interesting to me that the similarities between that period in history when many of these symbols were created, when people were worried about growing economic inequality. You know, it was a time of grossly exaggerated wealth and a huge inequality between the rich and the poor. And we then, after that, enjoyed a long period of relative equality, and we are now back in that period of massive inequality. And so it's not surprising to me that, as you said in the opening to this segment, that that a lot of people are feeling less patriotic, because those are the people who feel like patriotism, like I do, is about pursuing a better life for all of us, not just the selfish pursuit of wealth for oneself. And we're in a period in America that is both not in line with those goals and in some ways a dangerous period.
We're talking with Joel Westheimer. He is the University Research Chair in Democracy and Education at the University of Ottawa. And we're talking about patriotism in the U.S. after a new Gallup survey says Americans' pride in their country is down. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What does being patriotic mean to you? Have there been times in your life when you felt more patriotic than others? What was it about those moments that made you feel proud of your country or united with your fellow Americans? And do you have memories of times when you didn't feel proud of the country? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll pick up the conversation in just a bit. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. Right now, we're picking up our conversation about patriotism in the U.S. Joel Westheimer is with us. He's the University Research Chair in Democracy and Education at the University of Ottawa. And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Would you call yourself patriotic? If you do, what does it mean to you? And if you don't, what are some of the reasons you feel less comfortable with the word? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email us at ideas@wpr.org. And let's go to the phones, and Nancy in Milwaukee is up. Hi, Nancy.
Hello to you.
Hi.
I have about 0 degree of patriotism, and the reason I feel it this way is that I have felt for a long time that our elected officials are paying a hell of a lot more attention to their lobbyists than they are to their constituency, namely us. When it is well known that they spend a lot of their time calling their contacts looking at, for additional money so that they can run their next election. That is very discouraging to know that they're not even attending their own committee meetings. They're just always looking out for themselves. I feel that Trump is making the U.S. Laughingstock of the whole world. I feel we're really in very treacherous times.
Thank you for that call, Nancy. And a lot there, Joel. And, you know, it sounds like Nancy feels like her government is not working for her. And maybe in some ways it's working against her. Is that something that colors how people feel about being a patriot?
I think it is. And it's why we're seeing those Gallup numbers that we're seeing. And, you know, what's interesting, of course, is that, I agree with Nancy. This is a horrifying time in our country. It's a sad time that I hope we will get past and look back on. But there are people look at it in different ways. And in some ways, you could think of it as a matter of semantics, but I also wonder as a matter of strategy. So to say I'm not feeling particularly patriotic, and I've would feel the same way right now. I'm not proud of our country. On the other hand, it makes me think of the, you know, some who was it who said that, saying you're patriotic, saying that, you know, my country, right or wrong, is like saying my mother drunk or sober, with the idea that that's ridiculous. You don't stand by your country in all times. On the other hand, when you think about that, my mother drunk or sober, I mean, I would stand by my mother if she was drunk. I wouldn't try and enable that, but I would try and get her into rehab. I would try and, you know, make her better. And so for some people, patriotism is really about trying to make the country better and might feel more patriotic now than in better times.
We're talking with Joel Westheimer right now. He's the University Research Chair in Democracy and Education at the University of Ottawa. And on Facebook, Neil said that he is patriotic, but not in a flag-waving America First way. He thinks America should help relieve pain and suffering and make a safer world for everyone. And Joel, I think Neil is showing some of that complexity you just talked about, that it's not yes in this case, no in that case, and nothing in between.
I agree. And, you know, let's go back to Francis Bellamy, the pledge. What's the line? One nation, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all. Right. He intended that to express an egalitarian vision of America. It's a kind of way to it was a way to unite a divided nation at the time. And I think that's the same kind of patriotism we need right now.
Let's go back to the phones. And Kevin in Richland Center is up. Hi, Kevin.
Yeah, thanks a lot. Something I wrote this morning that I got was it has to do with colors on a flag on any flag that can blind people. I don't care what color is on a flag. I grew up during the Vietnam War, and the parallels to nationalism is it's always got to be monitored because they can become diseases. So the thing is the people didn't make the flag, or the flag didn't make the people made the flag. The flag doesn't wave the people wave the flag. But when the flag starts to burn people, maybe it's time to burn the flag.
Thank you, Kevin, for that comment. And Joel, that makes me think of places like Germany, where there is a real fear of a return of nationalism. And so that can sometimes lead to discouraging patriotism just to avoid that ultimate end.
Absolutely. And that was beautifully written, Kevin. I love that stuff about the colors and the flag. And I think that's right. And we all have a responsibility. If we really believe in the ideals of what this country was founded on, we all have a responsibility to think about the same things that Kevin is thinking about, but not to give up. But I think that, you know, try and recapture those ideals on which our country was founded. It was really, really beautifully put.
And Joel, you and your family were in New York City on September 11th, 2001, at the time of the attacks. Did that event have an impact on your feelings of patriotism or your definition of patriotism?
It did. The seeds of the book, my book, Pledging Allegiance, The Politics of Patriotism in America's Schools, came out of that experience. My wife and my, at the time, 4-year-old daughter and I stood on a street corner, and we watched the second plane hit the South Tower. We watched both towers collapse into those impossibly small streets below. And it was very surreal, very disturbing, of course. And, you know, we spent the next few months communing with New Yorkers. It was an amazing time in New York where people were talking about really important things, about what kind of society we want to live in. There's a literary theorist, Amanda Anderson, who talks about that she thinks the purpose of literary theory is to figure out how we want to live. And I think that's a nice guiding principle for a kind of democratic patriotism, too, is for us to come together to think about how we want to live, what ideals we want to stand for, and how to fight those. But 9/11 was very impactful to me and my family, not only in the tragic, because of the tragedy that it wrought, but also because of the kind of attention to the ideals that our republic was founded on, that it brought for a lot of people. Now, it also brought a much more ugly kind of patriotism for a lot of people, and that's the interesting and difficult thing about those kinds of events.
We heard from Brian on Facebook, who said he served this country for 11 years. I'm assuming that means militarily. And he refuses to wrap himself in the flag. Brian said, quote, "I would give my life for this nation." Is that patriotic? And how does that tie in to the ideas of, you know, serving the military? Often you have to follow orders and do what is said. And where does patriotism fit into that?
You know, when my book came out and I had some articles in magazines and there was a lot of press attention too, the largest number of letters I received and contacts were from ex-military people or current military people. And I really enjoyed dialoguing with them. And they were people like, did you say Brian?
Yes.
The people like Brian, but also people who took offense at the idea that we should be critical of the country. And we had terrific discussions. It was really the kind of discussions that seem so difficult to have now. I had a lot of back and forth. And yes, of course, you know, in a military and in many institutions, there's a lot of order, obeying orders. And, you know, I'm an educator. So I think about in schools, do you teach kids to follow the rules? And of course, you teach them to follow the rules. You teach them about laws and about how we get along with one another. But you can't only teach that. And that goes for soldiers, not just only soldiers, but maybe especially soldiers. We can only, you know, it's easy to look at World War II Germany to know what happens when an army blindly follows orders. And soldiers have to both follow orders, but always carry with them their own sense of themselves, of their values and their dignity. And at times, they might need to summon the courage not to follow orders, but to disobey them.
And Dennis on Facebook wrote something that I think really echoes what you just said, Joel. He wrote that patriotism means speaking the truth regardless of how unpopular it is. So he's saying that actually dissent can be the patriotic alternative instead of just falling in line.
You know, when it comes to if we still consider ourselves a democratic nation, one of the only things that separates us from a totalitarian nation is the idea of dissent. Dissent is in our DNA, and it should be encouraged and taught. And of course, it's not taught enough in schools. We teach kids to follow the rules, but we don't always teach them to question those rules. There's a saying among teachers that everyone likes to talk about teaching critical thinking, but no one wants a classroom full of critical thinkers. So, because you don't want kids questioning everything, but it's very important that kids learn that people have different opinions out there and that it's their job to weigh those different opinions and come to their own conclusions on what's important to them and what they want to fight for to make this a better country.
And very briefly, Joel, because we only have about 30 seconds left, in a nutshell, do you think patriotism is a positive thing?
Oh, such a tough question, Judith. You know, I want to recapture it. And I do think it's a positive thing in the way that Francis Bellamy, the author of The Pledge, thought it was, which is it gets people to think about something bigger than themselves. But it's also very dangerous because it's so often in history, and we're seeing it today as well, leads to a kind of patriotism that is a we're better than you and that we're in, you're out, and devalues the life of other people. And that's a dangerous form of patriotism. But if we can recapture its higher meaning, I think it's a good thing.
Well, Joel, thanks so much for joining us. That was Joel Westheimer, the University Research Chair in Democracy and Education at the University of Ottawa. He was with us today for a conversation about American patriotism on the 4th of July. After 67 years, Mad Magazine will cease almost all new publications later this year. It started as a comic book in 1952, but quickly became known for its biting satire and the freckle-faced, gap-toothed character Alfred E. Newman, whose frequent response to the world around him was, "What? Me worry?" WPR network operator Nigel O'Shea was a big fan and joins me to talk about it. Nigel, what did Mad mean to you growing up?
Well, you know, kids' books are great tools to learn to read, but I'll be perfectly frank. My motivation to read came from Mad Magazine. I was so compelled by the artwork and the goofiness of it, and I knew there was humor in there, you know, even before I could understand what that humor was, and I wanted to get to it. So I am happy to admit through my grade school years, our toilet had a stack of Mad Magazines, and I it was a go-to, and I would read them threadbare.
And it's interesting, when I told you it was stopping, you had a really kind of emotional response.
Oh, yeah, because so much I've learned about our world actually came from that satire, from that goofiness. Everything I know about youthful rebellion, you know, and that feeling of individuality, that came from Mad Magazine. And yeah, and the humor is still, you know, when I pick one up every once in a while, is still very good and very well thought up out. And, you know, like I said, the art is really well, and it's just a very, it's always been a compelling magazine to me, and I am very sorry to hear it's leaving.
Well, thanks for sharing that with us, Nigel.
Sure.
This is Central Time.